I'm Jay Moran.
I'm Bridget Jaipal Valenza.
I'm Thomas O'Neill White.
We need to get together and let our voices be heard.
This is What's Next. A dedicated hour to have important conversations about the issues facing the marginalized and underrepresented communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We're going to have some real healing. We've got to have space to tell some uncomfortable truth.
What's Next continues our mission to discuss race,
equity,
and the common concerns of Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
And welcome to What's Next. Thanks very much for joining us today. Today, an important discussion about an issue that really impacts all of us, but we're going to probably narrow this down just a little more specifically throughout this hour. Here's a key fact to know. Older Black Americans are twice as likely as older white Americans to develop Alzheimer's disease. With us, we have three individuals who were part of a recent Black Caregivers Conference at the Meriwether Library talking about this very issue. Robin Hodges is with us. Robin is a board member of the Western New York chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. Robin, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Also with us, we have Dr. Carliara Weiss, research assistant professor and clinician scientist at UB's Department of Geriatrics and Palliative Medicine. Doctor, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And also Andrea Cook, Director of Education and Training for the Western New York Chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. Andrea, I want to start with you because we come just by coincidence, I guess, to a certain extent, that this morning we know some new nationwide information when it comes to Alzheimer's. That information actually just breaking not long ago on NPR and heard here on WBFO. Why don't you, if you could, just talk about a couple of the highlights that we're seeing, things that may are a bit of a breakthrough in our understanding of Alzheimer's.
Sure, absolutely. Thanks for having us.
Oh, a pleasure.
Every year, the Alzheimer's Association releases a major facts and figures report, and our 2024 report just was released this morning. So some kind of highlights. We know that the number of people living with Alzheimer's disease is increasing. So over the past few years, it's gone up, and currently there are 6.9 million Americans facing Alzheimer's disease. Those are
currently diagnosed with it.
Correct. Okay. And that diagnosed piece is a key feature because I'm sure, as we're going to get into, a lot of folks don't get a diagnosis. So those are just folks who've been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease specifically. There's also other forms of dementia as well.
Sure.
That are not included in that number. We also know a little bit more on a county-by-county, state-by-state level. So we have some new figures that we know that there are at least 426,000 people just in New York State who have the diagnosis.
Okay.
The numbers in New York State compared to elsewhere in the country are high just because of population and the percentage of older adults here. But every year, this Facts and Figures report has kind of a special focus. This year, we were kind of honing in on the needs that families have in terms of navigating the healthcare system, that can be so challenging and so time-consuming, and the fact that more supports need to be put into place to help families feel comfortable, get the information that they need, and have better outcomes just by virtue of being able to navigate the healthcare system and feel like they have physicians and supportive professionals that they trust who are giving them information in a factual and timely manner. So we know that that's a great need, and it's going to be a greater need as our population in the U.S. ages. There's more older adults than ever before. The boomers, right, are entering older adulthood, or have already been. The older boomers have already been in older adulthood. So it's a huge chunk of the population who have a lot of evolving needs, and we need to find ways to better respond to them.
It all starts with the diagnosis, of course. Let's maybe talk about that just a little bit. When it comes to a diagnosis, first and foremost, what are maybe some of the things that we understand that makes, as Andrea mentioned, there's dementia and forms of dementia, but Alzheimer's, what makes it different and what gives it its unique characteristics?
So one of unique characteristics for Alzheimer's disease is the accumulation of metabolic waste in the brain. So that's what we call beta amyloids or amyloid plaques, and also there are other types of protein accumulations in the brain, such as p-tau protein that can accumulate there. And those are the characteristics that we look at for a diagnosis for Alzheimer's disease. And other types of dementia, for example, vascular dementia, we are looking at how the oxygen levels are in the brain. Or if you have frontotemporal dementia, we're looking specific at the frontal area of the brain for neural degeneration there. So Alzheimer's disease has this particular biomarkers for called the beta amyloids and the p-tau proteins accumulating in the brain, creating plaques that make the communication between the neurons difficult and affect the memory, and over time more and more debilitating for the course of the Alzheimer's disease.
Are those elements of it, can they be diagnosed through blood tests, or is that the way it's done? Yeah.
Yes. Nowadays, it can be diagnosed for a blood test. But 10, 20 years ago, the only way to look at that was by looking into the brain. So sometimes the person would only have diagnosed for Alzheimer's disease after they were dead. And then it evolved to be a PET scan or a spinal tap, and nowadays we can have that with blood tests. That's usually what I look at with my research as well. I look to people who yet don't have a diagnosis for Alzheimer's disease, but they already have those biomarkers circulating in their blood test.
That's encouraging in itself. Go ahead, Andre, you're going to add something.
Yeah, I just wanted to specify, so the blood test, that's something that's available in a research setting.
Yes.
That's still a brand new evolving technology, so that's not something that the average person, if they went to their primary care physician, would have access to, because those tests, we're still kind of getting the hang of it.
Exactly.
There's sometimes they give false positives and false negatives, so it's not widely available yet, but we're really close, and that's the future, because gosh, what a game changer. If anyone has ever gone through the process of getting a person diagnosed, for many years it's been this like interview, asking the person to remember these three words, draw a clock, all of these things. Blood tests, MRIs, or I'm sorry, blood tests looking for different things.
Sure.
MRIs and basically a diagnosis of exclusion. Once we have no other explanation,
exactly,
then we can say, okay, it's probably Alzheimer's. But now, there have been some really significant changes that we can do cerebral spinal fluid, a spinal tap, and look for those beta amyloid plaques in the spinal fluid. Or a person can get a PET scan, but those are not necessarily always available, and a lot of times insurance companies will kind of balk at the cost
Sure.
of that. So it's changing in a really positive way that we hope in the future, in the near future, it'll be as simple as going and getting some blood work, and as a result, being able to catch it early, because we know that Alzheimer's disease starts kind of brewing in the brain. The changes in the brain start occurring up to 10, maybe even 15 years before we ever start seeing symptoms in a person.
Wow.
So if we could catch it, thanks to a blood test, when it's still in that asymptomatic stage, and come up with an effective intervention at that point, then hopefully we can prevent the really significant symptoms that we think of with Alzheimer's disease from occurring, or certainly at least slowing that process down. It's a really exciting time, because we're hoping very soon we'll be able to sort of nip it in the bud, and that's brand new for Alzheimer's disease.
Yeah, that most certainly is encouraging, because unfortunately when we talk about Alzheimer's and dementia and dealing with our loved ones who are older, it's not a particularly positive conversation. And Robin Hodges, you have a lot of experience in this on a couple of different levels, both from your professional experience, but also dealing with your own mother. Let's go back and talk about Flora a little bit here, and what that was like for you, and perhaps how the process went in terms of just getting a diagnosis.
As Andrea was referring to, when my mother was diagnosed in 2008,
she had to take the little paper test and, you know, how many hands are on the clock and can you add 1 + 1 and you know, very elementary diagnosis, if you will. And my mother was funny because she would even, you know, play games with the doctor and say to the doctor, oh, no, she's the one, me, that there's something wrong with her. She has Alzheimer's, right? But the doctor said, well, maybe you do. But it was very challenging. And as Andrea said, that I'm certain, as I look back, that my mother should have been diagnosed many years before she was actually diagnosed. We noticed that she was repeating herself a lot. She would tell the same jokes about 10 times. Then she was becoming forgetful. She was misplacing things. She started to become accusatory, as if, you know, why did you take this and put this someplace else? And my mother was always very organized. My mother was a caretaker. She was a great wife, a phenomenal mother. She also was a reading specialist at one point in her life. My mother took care of everything that had to do with the business. My parents had a lot of property. They had a delicatessen store. My father worked at Bethlehem Steel for like 35 years. He was the first black foreman in the coke ovens there. And so everything on the other outside business, the real estate and all, my mother took care of all of that.
Wow.
It was super organized. So when things started to become a little disheveled, I started to look at things and say, there's something that's not quite right.
And that, it's interesting because I do know a little bit more about your story, courtesy of our pre-preparation. And to hear you talking about your mother when she was at the height of her powers, it came to a situation where your family, basically, they lost their home, right?
Yes,
because
yes.
She was the one keeping an eye on things.
Yes, she was keeping an eye on everything. My parents were very independent. And so my father was determined that my mother would not, you know, go into an in-home nursing situation, that she would remain home. We had in-home care. We also sent her to a day program. A lot of this was an exorbitant amount of money that we were spending. And I would ask my father, so is everything paid? Is everything good? Everything's good. Everything's fine. But everything wasn't fine. So when I found out that the house was in foreclosure, it was too late. And so we lost the house. My father lost the house. But this was after my mother passed away.
Okay.
I think it would have been too much for her.
Sure.
God knew exactly what he was doing. And so almost a year to the date that she passed away, my father was evicted from the home.
Oh, my.
The story went totally international. My father is a World War II vet. He was 90 years old. It was all over the place. And from the time that he was evicted, which I believe was around July the 15th of 2015, we were able to get the house back in November of 2015.
Well,
it was a total miracle. There's a whole lot to that whole story.
Sure.
But we were able to get the house back. And I'm here because I am a true advocate for not only African Americans, but for veterans as well, because I myself am a veteran too.
And your father was?
Yes,
yes.
Absolutely. He was a World War II veteran.
Yeah. Dr. Weiss, you also have a personal story when it comes to dealing with Alzheimer's. You're originally from Brazil. So tell us a little bit about that particular case.
Yes, I'm originally from Brazil, and I grew up in an intergenerational household, meaning that my great-grandmother, my grandmother, my mom, and I in the same house. So growing up with this generational household, I was able to witness my great-grandmother and my grandmother going through Alzheimer's disease without a proper diagnosis. And the symptoms definitely started about 10 years before we noticed that something was off. Growing up, I have helped take care of my great-grandmother about the age of 14 years old. And with the misplacing things or changing her behavior, also she used to be a very kind person and became not as kind because of the progression of the disease as well, which is common, but at the time we didn't know. We just account that to being old and to getting old.
Right.
I'm first generation going to college, and I wanted to go to college for something that would honor my great-grandmother, who was a doula. But after getting to college, I realized that my passion was really taking care of older people. Mm-hmm. So I became a geriatric nurse. And by the time that my grandmother now had Alzheimer's disease, I was a little more prepared to deal with that. But how the disease progression goes and how the what we know about Alzheimer's in the past 20 years changed so much that now we have more support and more tools available to take care of our loved ones. But growing up with this perspective shaped who I am as a person and also who I am as a geriatric caretaker and as a scientist.
Let's maybe have that conversation then about how beneficial it is now to understand, to get the diagnosis earlier, and also to understand what is ahead and how this might benefit family members and, of course, the person that's being cared for. What about that? How do we see that different now than we saw years ago?
Sure, yeah. So we've had some really amazing scientific breakthroughs in recent years. There was a new medication that was FDA approved just in July of 2023 that can actually affect the underlying biological cause or biological effects, rather, of Alzheimer's disease. We don't know the cause, but we know, as I've heard a physician say, we don't know who invites the mess to the party. we don't know how they get there, but we can spot them once they arrive.
Okay.
So we can deal with some of those unwanted party guests now in a way that we've never been able to in the past. So now there's the availability of this new medication. And there's some more that are currently going through the approval process with the FDA. And those medications are only effective if a person takes them when they're very early on in the disease.
Okay.
These medications, they've been studying them for quite some time now, but the early studies, they were giving it to folks who were in sort of the moderate stage of the disease, and they weren't effective. Once they started focusing on the folks who were still very early on, they realized that they could actually have a significant impact in terms of clearing those beta amyloid plaques that Dr. Weiss mentioned out of the brain. And that's what causes brain cells to die, and that's what causes the symptoms that we see with Alzheimer's disease. So by clearing those plaques out, it slows cell death and is able to slow the disease from continuing to progress. But again, you've got to get a diagnosis early in order for those to be effective. So now more than ever, we're really encouraging folks, the Alzheimer's Association is encouraging folks, if you see something, get it checked out. Because time, especially early on, is truly of the essence to make sure that you have access to these things. But even medication aside, and of course that's very much an individual decision, there's some side effects that need to be kind of considered, and it may not work for everyone. And it only works on Alzheimer's disease. It doesn't work on other types of dementia. We've still got a ways to go for those treatments. But regardless, getting that diagnosis early allows families to plan. Putting your affairs in order, making legal and financial plans, and kind of checking items off your bucket list while the person is still able to participate and enjoy that, they can have a say in what they want their future to look like past the point where then they're going to be able to be part of that conversation later on. They can chime in now and make their wishes known. But in particular, those legal and financial pieces, you know, if a person gets to a point that they can't legally, based on their cognition, sign a document anymore, then it becomes this whole drawn-out procedure with the courts that's incredibly expensive. So getting those things, you know, getting a power of attorney, healthcare proxy, things like that in place early is of the utmost importance to ensure smooth sailing down the road when those need to come into action.
You know, Robin, I think maybe we did kind of touch upon this originally with your story about your mother, Flora, but as you hear that, and obviously you're well-educated as a board member of Alzheimer's Association as well, but I hate to ask you about, you know, do you ever go through what if? What could we have done this? But do you have some experience, some wisdom from that time that you can share that, you know, if this is your loved one and this is what's happening, this is what you can do?
I strongly recommend contacting the Alzheimer's Association.
Okay.
Who will walk anyone through the entire process. There's so many resources available, from getting help from elder law to putting your financial affairs in order, power of attorney, healthcare proxy. All of these things are available. Getting in-home help and reaching out to various agencies that provide sometimes free care that you don't have to pay for. Mm. I mean, what, you know, we experienced, we had to pay out of pocket because we weren't prepared. So therefore, we got to the point where my mother really could not sign any documents because it was too late in the diagnosis process that, you know, she just could not at that point. I mean, she could sign, but we knew that cognitively she was not prepared or able to do so.
What about the emotional element there, though, as well? For you, for your father, is there some, I mean, do you feel like if you knew something a little differently, that maybe that process could have been easier for you?
I think we could have just been more prepared. Hmm. Some of the things, as Andrea said, you know, we could have, like, checked off the bucket list. There were things that my mother really wanted to do.
What did she want to do, do you know? I mean, you recall?
She never traveled to an island like Jamaica or Aruba or whatever, or she never went on a cruise. Those things could have taken place. I always have said that we would do such a thing, but it never happened. And because I was part of the sandwich generation, I had, was the mother of twin sons who at the time when she was diagnosed were 12 years old. And then I had a 2-year-old.
Unbelievable.
And then taking care of two elderly parents. My father was very healthy, very with it, even until the time that he passed away. He was very sharp, sharper than I am right now. But it was very, very challenging, very difficult to watch my mother just deteriorate before my very own eyes.
Mm. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back in with more conversation here. We have with Robin Hodges, Andrea Cook, and Dr. Carliara Weiss with us today. As we're talking about Alzheimer's, we're going to get into some more specifics, especially some of the impacts on the Black community as well. This is What's Next on WBFO.
Check out the WBFO DocuHour, a series of insightful and enlightening audio documentaries from our region. Listen to WBFO DocuHour every Saturday at 6 p.m. right here on WBFO.
Hey, educators. You've been asking for it, and it's here. Reading Rainbow Stories is ready to help your students stay on track. Each story is paired with activities to help students strengthen cross-curricular skills such as math and business in Lemonade for Sale.
Let's keep track of our sales.
Science and health in Germs Make Me Sick.
Usually, you feel better after a day or two.
Thanks.
But if you don't, you should see a doctor.
And history in Following the Drinking Gourd.
One of the worst things about slavery is that families were separated. Fathers, mothers, and children were oftentimes sold to different people.
Check out the new Reading Rainbow Stories collection on PBS Learning Media today to help your students stay on track.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
And welcome back to What's Next. With us, we have Robin Hodges, board member of the Western New York Chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. Andrea Cook is the director of education and training for the Western New York Chapter. And Dr. Carliara Weiss is the research assistant professor and clinician scientist at UB's Department of Geriatrics and Palliative Medicine. We mentioned this at the top. Older Black Americans are twice as likely as older white Americans to develop Alzheimer's. Who wants to take the question? Perhaps we'll put this to our researcher. Why? Why is that the case? Do we have any understanding why that's the case?
So as a research standpoint, we have a few theories or a few hypotheses to explain that. The first hypothesis is that from being from an African descendant, that is a gene that is associated with some mutations in the brain that can increase the likelihood of having Alzheimer's disease. The second hypothesis to that is associated with the body of research that I do, looking at sleep disturbances, as African Americans are more likely to have sleep disturbances that go undiagnosed, like obstructive sleep apnea or insomnia. So they have a shorter sleep duration. Having a short sleep duration impairs how the brain cleans the metabolic waste with the beta amyloids and the p-tau proteins. So sleeping less than 6 hours increases accumulation of this brain waste and more likely to have Alzheimer's disease. And then another hypothesis is that having more comorbidities such as diabetes or cardiovascular disorders, and also that can increase likelihood of having Alzheimer's, just how affecting the health in a whole and also affecting the brain health for having those diseases.
And Andrea, I saw you quoted in a Buffalo News article about, I guess it was called weathering, right?
Yeah.
Weathering, that also adding to it, you know, the Black community, of course, has and continues to deal with systemic racism. That we understand or believe is part of this as well.
Yeah, there's a growing body of research looking into this concept that tip of the hat to the Code Switch team at NPR, because that's where I learned about this.
Interesting.
You know, there's been a lot of research into things like, we know that, rates of morbidity among Black women in childbirth are so much higher. And it's not necessarily about access to prenatal health care. It kind of divides, you know, it crosses socioeconomic lines. We just know that it's higher. And there's been a lot of increasing research trying to understand why this is, that it's not, you know, a factor related to poverty. This seems, you know, it crosses those lines. So, there's this growing body of research looking into just the kind of ongoing experience of racism. You know, little things like being followed around a fancy store while shopping, or, you know, being concerned about being pulled over when you're driving in a nice neighborhood. You know, things that, you know, they might call microaggressions that folks of color experience on a day-to-day basis. It just leads to greater stress loads for folks. And there's been some research out of the University of Michigan, their School of Public Health, showing that on a chromosomal level, if they look at chromosomes for indicators of kind of age in a person, that African-American women on average appear 7.5 years older than their white counterparts on the chromosomal level. And they think that stress has a lot to do with this. So that can also lead to those other comorbidities, the other health factors that come into play. So, you know, you can't chalk it up as just a poverty thing. You can't kind of dismiss it. It's just the stress of experiencing sometimes very overt and sometimes subtle forms of racism in our society.
It's startling.
Yeah.
Robin, I turn to you because you brought this up earlier as well, that another part of this is also there's a sense that, African Americans are they are maybe less likely to reach out for a diagnosis. Is that the case?
It is. It is. I am currently working with two different families right now, and a lot of times we as African Americans, we like to keep things like quiet. We don't believe that, you know, it's just attributed to aging, and certainly my loved one couldn't have that disease, that horrific disease. We are sometimes, and I think it has to do a lot with, you know, subtle racism and how if we've reached out and tried to ask questions, like we would get kind of like shunned, and, you know, someone would say, well, you know, why are you asking that question? Or a sense of that the diagnosis, a researcher would not necessarily say that you as a black person, like, no, you don't have that. Or, you know, just a feeling of not being accepted.
Right.
By the medical community. Mm-hmm. And
trusting the medical community. Mm-hmm. It's historically, we know that the relationship has been damaged by prejudice and racism. So having the diagnosis for Alzheimer's disease associated with that is difficult for the person to trust the health system that for so many years have a disservice to them as far as racism goes. So when it comes to have a diagnosis for a chronic disease that we don't have a cure yet, as Alzheimer's disease is, and is as debilitating and has a heavy load for the person and for the family caregiver, that is a bombastic diagnosis to have. Mm-hmm. So placing that on the context of microaggression and racism, and also in the historical context for African Americans, that we have a higher standard for the matriarch of the family,
right,
and the patriarch of the family as our grandparents. Though this combination is very delicate, and it's not been taking care of, explored yet in a way that would satisfy giving a diagnosis with the support system that needs to take in place when this diagnosis is placed.
Is there also just the idea of just getting the information out to people? You know, when we do hear about this, you know, people in the East Side, you know, just there's a certain, for a lot of different reasons, I think, you know, a lot of it has to do with poverty, structural racism as well. But important health and life information is not getting to the people who need it most. Is that something we see as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yes. And we can look at that from research perspective, too. The research that we have in place now says that the educational level that is provided, it's different, either by prejudice from the healthcare provider sometimes that don't think that the person will understand or that the person needs that type of education, or as a point of availability, really. So the information is not available in when a place that the person can take that easily. So events like we have for the Black Caregivers Conference, we can all get together and talk about things and see that things that are happening with this family is similar to that family, but they didn't have the education to talk about that early on and get prepared to deal with the Alzheimer's disease progression.
I'm glad you mentioned the Black Caregivers Conference. It was the fourth annual over at the Meriwether Library in February. Let's maybe have a conversation about that. What was gathered from that? And maybe even let's take a step back, the purpose of it as well, to have it, and specifically at the Meriwether Library as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think as more research has emerged about how serious Alzheimer's disease is as a threat to the Black community in particular, at the Alzheimer's Association, we've known we have to do more. So we started this conference online during COVID. And then as the world started opening back up, we felt really strongly about having an in-person presence, having it on the East Side in particular. You know, the Frankie Merriweather Library is just a hub of activity at all times. Great place to catch people. So having the online presence, but also making it available via Zoom for folks who can't make it. So the conference has just kind of grown over the years, and we're just delighted to be able to bring in really wonderful speakers to speak to many aspects of the issue. So we had a speaker this year to talk about caregiver stress and setting healthy boundaries as a caregiver, which, you know, it's the old adage of, you know, if you got to put your own oxygen mask on first before you help someone else. A burnt out caregiver isn't much help to anybody, right? A lot of emphasis on helping caregivers take better care of themselves. We also have, I should mention, an ongoing monthly support group at the Merriweather Library for caregivers, as well as another one at the Westminster Community House on Monroe Avenue. So just helping families access that support, giving them information about the free services. And then we were also delighted to have Dr. Weiss join us and talk about her research into sleep. And I know I've heard from a lot of people, including Robin, how impactful that was for folks who know that they've seen this disease or some other form of dementia in their families, to say, I want to know about the latest research because I don't know what's coming down the road for me. It's a scary thing, and having that family history increases your risk as well.
Was there a sense at the conference of that the information, obviously people are coming, they're interested, mm-hmm. they have an interest, they have a vested interest in the situation, but I guess I'm wondering about the energy in the conference. Did it feel like there was connections being made, that people were coming away with a better understanding of their circumstances?
Absolutely. And I, talking about this, as a member of the community and also as a scientist, I had so many people reach out to me after the conference saying that, Dr. Weiss, I don't sleep well. I would like to be part of your research, but also how can I help my family understand about this research also? Is there any resource available? Research sometimes has a hard time connecting to the community. Mm. So this participation in the Black Conference made a turning point for me to reach out to the community, for the research, if for the community also to reach out to us and want to know more, wants to learn about what Alzheimer's disease is and how they can take care of themselves and take better care of their family member that has Alzheimer's.
And did you are more people going to be part of studies and things along
yes.
those lines?
Yes.
Really? I mean, so we can only get so far into that with privacy, for sure. But at the same time, I'm going to ask Robin a little bit of a question there. You heard Andrea talking about burnout for caregivers. Is that something you experienced?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Absolutely. Totally exhausted. Mentally, emotionally, spiritually, physically. Very exhausting. And as for me, you know, being in that sandwich generation and trying to take care of my children and working and caring for my parents and making sure that, you know, their doctor's appointments were, you know, that they could go to their doctor's appointments, that my mother was okay and that my dad was okay. And then dealing with the in-home care
right.
was very challenging. I would get calls sometimes. I only live like 7 minutes away from my parents, and I would get calls at 3 o'clock in the morning because the dynamics in the home was different. Usually if there's an aide in the home or a nurse in the home to take care of that particular patient, it's just that patient. But then we had my dad there who was overseeing everything, who was very, very, very tough. And so either he or the aide or both were calling me saying, you gotta do something about this because, you know, she's not doing whatever she's supposed to do for, you know, your mother or whatever. And so very, very challenging, very stressful.
Did you find any outlets to keep you going there? Or did you almost seem like you're the type that is not going to bow down to any kind of pressure.
I prayed a lot. Yeah. I did. I mean, that was my outlet.
And that helped you get through?
That helped me to get through. There was no other way that I would have been able to get through, because I really didn't have time or, I guess, an outlet. And at the time, I wasn't very connected with the Alzheimer's Association, which I know that there is respite care available. But I'm not sure even if that would have been an option, because my father probably would have been resistant to that. Mm-hmm. No, we're not sending your mother to somebody else's house for them to watch her while we get a break. But we did get somewhat of a break when she was going to the day program.
Okay.
But then he was getting a break, but then I was at work. So,
yeah. Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, then is there a general thought then about how to move past those objections? Like you said, your father, no, this isn't going to happen. I mean, or do you just... I mean, do we have to, are those things we just have to accept, maybe? Yeah?
Yeah, most of the time.
Most of the time. Right, we're going to take one more time out. We'll come back with our final moments. We're talking about Alzheimer's today. Older Black Americans are twice as likely as older white Americans to develop Alzheimer's. And if you heard Andrea Cook earlier, 6.8 million Americans right now diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and that's the key word there, diagnosed. We've got a lot to talk about, and we'll get back with more. This is What's Next on WBFO.
Did you know that WNED PBS is always working on great new local shows for you to watch? Documentaries like Kleinhand's Gift to Buffalo, which tells the story of Buffalo's Music Hall.
The hall is very intimate, and that intimacy makes everyone who comes in here feel a part of our family.
Fun and educational series like Compact Science.
Believe it or not, peppers are technically fruits.
And Shakespeare's greatest hits, featuring some of his best-known soliloquies and monologues.
We are such stuff as dreams are made of.
You can watch them all on our website at wned.org/local shows. While you're there, check out the show pages and mini websites for additional content such as bonus features, photo galleries, and lesson plans. Find it all at wned.org/local shows.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
And welcome back to What's Next. We continue our conversation on Alzheimer's this morning. With us, Andrea Cook, Director of Education and Training for the Western New York Chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. Also with us, Dr. Carliara Weiss. Dr. Weiss is a research assistant professor and clinician scientist at UB's School of Nursing. And also with us, Robin Hodges, board member of the Western New York Chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. I also want to give you a little shout out here, Robin. You're also Chief Operations and Impact Officer for the African American Veterans Monument as well. Congratulations on work you're doing there.
Thank you so much.
I just want to jump back to you, Robin, because we did break, and I apologize, because I know this is, we're talking about your mom and your dad, of course, but do you take... What when you think back to your mom, do you think about those days of her dealing with Alzheimer's and the stress that you're under, or what, do you have other thoughts about her? I guess I'm just asking you, how much of an impact has Alzheimer's had on, you know, how you're just your memories of your family?
It has had a tremendous impact, even on my sons. Mm. Who, my twins are now 29, and my youngest is 17, who remembers my mother, even though he was only 6 years old. But my mom was, she was just a gem. You know, she was that special grandmother that loved everyone. She just loved people. She cooked a lot. No one was a stranger. And very involved in her church, and then of course with her children and grandchildren. My brother lives out of town, but still, you know, with my brother and his children, just always caring for someone. And I think a lot of times, and I know that, you know, we talk about stress, And I now realize the tremendous amount of stress that my mother was under. She always worried. And that is that's a big concern. And I have a tendency to be the same way. So I'm trying to be very mindful and do other things like, you know, meditation. My twins are both yogis. And so they constantly remind me, you know, you need to meditate, you need to take a break, you've got to take care of yourself. Because they said, you know, because if we knew then what we know now, we think that grandma would have been maybe still with us, and, you know, maybe something could have changed.
That's interesting. Now, is there some advice, though, that the association gives now to people as the caregivers, their parents, their loved ones are going through Alzheimer's?
Yeah, gosh, I think just knowing that you're never alone. Mm. The Alzheimer's Association has a 24/7 helpline that you can call at, you know, get that call from Dad at 3 o'clock in the morning and then hang up and call us and say, I'm losing my mind. you know, we're there for just that. So, you know, helping folks know that they are not alone, because caregiving can be a really isolating experience. It can feel like me against the world sometimes. So knowing that help is a phone call away anytime, and that we also have education programs and support groups and all sorts of different free resources, safety services that we can connect folks to. And I think that, you know, Robin mentioned she wasn't as involved with us when she was going through it, and that's the thing that we hate hearing the most. Right. That, you know, I wish I'd known about you guys when I was going through this. Because we have a lot to offer, and everything is free and confidential. So just helping folks know that it's okay to ask for help. I've heard it said, you're a veteran, Robin. I've heard it said that, many people will be caregivers in their lifetime. Most people will be caregivers in some capacity in their lifetime. The caregivers of people with dementia are like the Green Berets in the Army. It's tough stuff. So, knowing that no one should ever have to go through that alone. And there's lots of resources for help.
Obviously, it's a very difficult conversation on a lot of different levels, but the research that's being done, it sounds like, first and foremost, right now, where we're at right now, is so much further than we were 20 years ago, which is very encouraging. What about moving forward? I mean, you can't necessarily predict, but it does seem like the researchers know what's on the other side of the glacier, when it comes to change, right? What do you see?
Yeah, so I feel like as a researcher, we are looking at the future. Mm. That's why I was explaining about the blood test. That's the future. That's right. What we want to head to. It's available through research, but
you feel like that's going to be widespread eventually.
Yes, we wanted that in a clinical level to be available. We want to look also into medication, have more medications as options for people who get diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, and particularly to prevention. So if we know the mechanism, what is happening in the brain that caused Alzheimer's disease, as I was explaining about the beta amyloid, the plaques that formate there, how can we prevent those plaques to create in the brain? So sleep is one of the reasons why they accumulate there. So how can we sleep better and take better care of ourselves so to prevent the accumulation of this metabolic waste and prevent Alzheimer's disease? So that would be one of the areas of the research that we are looking at for the future, create effective ways to prevent Alzheimer's disease. And in the other side, having an early diagnosis and early treatment for Alzheimer's disease.
And there's at least two of us in this room that don't sleep very much. But are there suggestions, though, other options, other things that people could do, just basic health concepts that we can focus on?
Yeah, so the Alzheimer's Association has done a lot of research into lifestyle factors, and we have a growing body of evidence that there's things healthy living wise that can really lower your risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. So we know that exercise is really important. Getting some physical exercise, getting and staying moving, having...
Is it just movement or is it more of an aerobic kind of thing?
Cardiovascular exercise in particular, just something that gets the heart pumping and, you know, provides that extra, jolt of good oxygenated blood to the brain. 25% of the blood from each heartbeat goes straight to the brain, which is a lot when you consider the real estate the heart has to cover, right? So because of that, we know that what's good for the heart is also good for the brain, and there's more science growing behind that. So exercise, diet, kind of a Mediterranean-style diet, has been associated with healthy aging. God knows in Buffalo, we're not huge fans of things that aren't fried, right? But
are there things that aren't fried?
Corned beef last weekend, the butter lambs are on the shelves, right? So healthy choices, a couple meals a week, if nothing else, right? Staying socially active, getting good sleep, and just keeping your brain active, learning new things, listening to NPR, but that social connection piece also is huge. And we learned a lot about that during COVID, that isolation really does a number on people.
Did we see an increase in Alzheimer's?
We saw a 17% increase in death of folks with Alzheimer's disease during COVID that can't be attributed to those folks having COVID. People declined faster and died earlier as a result of isolation and, it just being, healthcare just being such a mess during that time. We saw an increase in death during that period. So we know that social isolation is a real factor that people need to consider.
I saw a lot of head nodding as Andrea is speaking. Robin or Dr. Weiss, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, so social isolation and depression that comes with social isolation. We tend to think about depression as just the psychiatric aspect of it, but we need to think about that with the neurophysiology also that changes the brain chemistry when we are depressed, such as that we have medication that treats that biochemistry imbalance, right? So a person that has Alzheimer's disease and is depressed is a double take in the brain, biochemistry and the physiology of the brain also for neurodegeneration. So it's not surprising that social isolation with the potential depression that comes with increase the morbidity of the disease and more likely that they would die faster with having the combination of those.
And Robin, how about for you? Any thoughts about that? I mean, you have both the experience of being on the ground, being that caregiver, and now also trying to help out other people as well.
Well, I just think that, as they both just said with COVID, I can't imagine being basically isolated as a caregiver and one with Alzheimer's on a daily basis for months.
Mm.
The weather did get better, so, we were able to maybe go outside in our yard or whatever, but... I can imagine how one would just kind of give up and not really knowing, no one knew what was happening during COVID. So if the Alzheimer's patient had any indication of what was going on at all, they would probably just give up.
We've got about 2 minutes left. Maybe a final thought from each of our panelists today. Andrea Cook, let's start with you. Thoughts of, again, let's focus on hope. How does that sound instead of the other side of coin? How about that?
Gosh, it is a really exciting time in Alzheimer's research. I've been with the association almost 8 years, and I have so much hope today. It's the landscape is changing so quickly, and I'm really excited. But I folks please know, if anyone is facing this, call that 800 number, go on our website. And if you missed the conference, we have a recording available. Oh. So please reach out. You could watch it online. So,
very good.
But yeah, just know you're never alone.
Dr. Weiss, how about for you?
I second the hope for the research and that we are together with Alzheimer's Association at the School of Nursing. We are together to provide this hope through the research and through care also.
And Robin, any
thoughts? I agree. There's a lot of hope. I mean, since the time that I was exposed to Alzheimer's back in 1986 until now, and how things have really progressed in the research and the medications and the, it's just so much hope for better tomorrow.
Robin Hodges, thanks for sharing the story of your mother, Flora, and thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Robin Hodges is board member of the Western New York chapter of the Alzheimer's Association, Andrea Cook, director of education and training, and Dr. Carliara Weiss with the UB School of Nursing. Thanks for joining us today on What's Next. This is What's Next on WBFO and WBFO HD1 Buffalo, WOLN Olean, and WUBJ Jamestown, your NPR station.